welcome to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York, on the unceded homelands of the Mohican people who are known today as the Stockbridge-Munsee community. I'm Sally Becker.
And I'm Mark Dunlap. Today on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, we begin with an overview of the fight to reduce overtime hours for farm workers. Then, for our peace bucket, we review the present conflict in Israel and Palestine. Later on, we hear about Black August from folks involved with all of us. After that, we will hear from Sandra Deer's stand-up about a community-supported land-back effort in Schoharie County. And we conclude with a segment about Arthur's Point Farm in Ghent, New York, which supports ecological agriculture and land restoration. But first, here are the headlines.
Former President Donald Trump invoked his Fifth Amendment protection against self-incrimination as he testified under oath Wednesday in the New York Attorney General's long-running civil investigation into his business dealings. The Fifth Amendment protects people from being compelled to be witnesses against themselves in a criminal case. The Manhattan District Attorney is conducting a criminal investigation of Trump.
Sal Farino, the varsity basketball coach for the LaSalle Cadets in Troy, recently died from complications from injuries he received in an automobile accident in January.
Drivers entering the heart of New York City would pay an extra $9 to $23 as soon as the end of next year, under a plan aimed at reducing congestion. The congestion pricing proposal was included in an environmental assessment released Wednesday that is part of the federal regulatory process.
In a shocking development, the Time Union reports that a group of fly fishing enthusiasts and conservations had convinced the State Department of Environmental Conservation to alter a periodic trout count due to the unusually hot weather, which stresses brown and brook trout populations. Anglers fear the use of electric shocks used to stun the fish for counting would have deadly consequences amid the already stressful warmth.
Channel 6 reports that South End residents at a City of Albany Planning Board hearing expressed strong opposition to the expansion plans of the Capital City Rescue Mission. The mission said it is not seeking to increase the number of homeless individuals it serves, but to improve existing services, including better beds for those it shelters. Residents and elected officials said the mission has been a nuisance, especially with the Griffin Elementary School only a block away.
A new state report found that between one-third to two-thirds of the state's native pollinators are at risk of elimination. The report by DEC and the SUNY College of Environmental Science and Forestry recommended that habitat preservation and restoration efforts should weigh requirements of the rare species presence in a habitat to ensure that management practices and actions will not adversely affect the most vulnerable species and their habitats. That's it for the headlines.
The efforts to reduce the threshold for overtime for farm workers from 60 to 40 hours has stalled even after the state provided additional funding to farm workers to help pay for the change. Mark talks with Reverend Richard Witt of the Rural Migrant Ministry about the ongoing effort.
We're joined by Reverend Richard Witt, who's head of Rural Migrant Ministry. And we've talked to Reverend Witt over the years about, you know, trying to get a Farm Worker Bill of Rights, which eventually did pass. But a big issue has been the issue of overtime, and particularly trying to lower the limit from 60 hours to 40 hours, which seems to be supported by the State Labor Department proceedings. But, the farmers continue to push back. So, Richard, what is the latest situation with the issue of settling overtime for farm workers?
Oh, it's good to be with you, Mark. The latest is that it's not quite clear what the latest is. The wage board took a vote many months ago to recommend that there be a schedule over the next 10 years to lower the threshold for farm workers in regards to overtime pay from 60 hours to eventually 40 hours. That vote passed, and then the process was that it had to be written up with a report and given to the governor, and in turn that had to be shared for public comment with New York residents. And it's not quite clear whether that report has been given to the governor or not after all these months. And so we're not quite clear what the deadline is. We've been told that the governor is very supportive of this. Clearly, the wage board's supportive of this because they voted in favor of it. However, subsequently, the governor is joined by the lieutenant governor, who had been opposed to lowering the threshold.
As Antonio Delgado, former congressperson, yes, representing Upper Hudson Valley.
Right. And when he was in Congress, he was opposed to this. They have embarked upon a statewide tour of listening to agricultural leaders' concerns and interests about agriculture in general in New York. And they're going around the state with different scheduled forums. Obviously, what keeps coming up is the farm worker overtime bill and lots of voices speaking out against it. What we're concerned about at Rural Migrant Ministry is, where are the farm worker voices in this process, and how can their voices be heard? And let's get this done, because every day that goes by is another day where farm workers are being cheated out of their fair and equal pay that other New Yorkers are getting. The other thing I should tell you, Mark, is that the budget that was passed this spring included subsidies, once again, for New York agriculture to cover the cost of cover the increased costs related to overtime pay. So I'm not really clear what the issue is here.
Yeah, and I do remember we had, I believe, discussed that shortly after his pass, and that was, basically a big carrot to the farmer, because, seemed to be the general consensus, well, this should, finally lock it up. But the farmers argue, farming is not a 9-to-5, business like, most enterprises. And so, therefore, we should honor and respect the tradition that farm workers get to work a whole lot more hours. And it's really unfair, even though we just got this tax credit, to make us pay them, a little higher wage once they go above 40 hours a week. How do the farmer workers respond to that type of argument?
I think that what we've said all along is that there needs to be an equality in New York State. If certain businesses, the majority of which are required to pay overtime, why is agriculture excluded from that? There is no moral justification for treating them differently. I'm sure that the family-owned pharmacy on the corner would love to say, we can't afford to pay overtime pay. But they're paying overtime pay. And why should the farm workers subsidize the farmers' livelihood? Because that's what's happening right now. And on top of all that, that economic issue is addressed in the budget. The farmers are getting a subsidy. So let's move on and focus on how we all can make New York agriculture strong, and let's have all voices involved in these forums and discussions where the future of New York agriculture is being discussed and explored.
Now, I remember when I worked for the Hunger Action Network, we often looked at, the prices of food in the United States actually tend to be cheaper than other industrial nations. But actually, most of the food didn't go to the farmers, went to the middlemen, the processors, even the supermarkets. But what is the impact of labor costs on, what we're paying at the store for food prices?
Well, labor is the one thing really that agriculture, farmers, growers can have somewhat of a voice in controlling. But labor costs are but a small piece of this. And consumers that we've talked to, and I travel across the state repeatedly, have all said that they would be more than willing to pay a little bit extra if it ensured the just treatment of farm workers. And we've always said at Rural Mega Ministry, this is about the just treatment of farm workers and the just treatment of farmers. We need to make the system work. We can't continue a system that depends for its, one could argue, whether survival or thriving on the backs of one particular population.
Now, of course, we are having a governor's race this November, and it does seem that Governor Hochul has been trying to push off, some, I guess, touchy political decisions until after the election. You mentioned it earlier, but A, is it her actual decision, or is the labor commissioner finally made the decision? But, what's sort of the outside of the timeline for, the governor actually does make the decision, being clear about how she's going to stand on this issue?
The labor commissioner in New York reports to and is in place because of the governor. So ultimately, the governor does have controlling voice and interest in this. And we're very concerned as we look at the upcoming election, because the one candidate running against the governor appears to be making the farm worker overtime issue one of his prime talking points. We have this tendency to really focus on the needs of farmers to the exclusion of focusing on the men, women, and children who are the farm workers. And why can't we focus on all?
So we've been talking about Reverend Richard Witt, Rural Migrant Ministries. People want more information about this issue, even weigh in with the governor. How best can they do that?
They can always go to our website, www.ruralmigrantministry.org. There's been some excellent pieces in the Daily News editorials about that. They can Google those editorials to get a clear sense. And I would urge that if they're concerned about the just treatment of farm workers, that they reach out to the governor of New York and share their feelings and concerns.
Thank you very much. And this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk magazine.
I'll mention that this is very much a racial justice issue. Overwhelmingly, the people who are farm workers are people of color. And that's one of the reasons when the initial federal labor laws were passed as part of the New Deal, both farm workers and housekeepers, also overwhelmingly in that case Black, were excluded. So after 25 years, we're almost to the finish line on this issue, and we'll continue until the moment this is resolved.
Israel has launched airstrikes against Gaza since Friday, and killed at least 43 Palestinians, including 15 children and 4 women. Israel claims it was launching a preemptive strike against a group called Palestinian Islamic Jihad. Israel had arrested a senior member of the group last week. For our peace segment, Tom Ellis of the local Palestinian Rights Committee talks with Sina about the situation.
My name is Tom Ellis. I work as a teacher at a not-for-profit school, and I teach social studies, and I've also worked in support of Palestinian rights for about 40 years since I first met Palestinians. And I'm part of a group called the Palestinian Rights Committee, which we formed in 1982 after the Israeli invasion of Lebanon.
Welcome to Hudson Mohawk Magazine, or returning, your familiar voice on Hudson Mohawk Magazine. Currently, there was a recent attack in Palestine. What is going on? What just happened?
Where to begin? Israel did a preventive attack, or so they said, on Palestinians in the Gaza Strip, and I think they killed 45 or 46 people, including 16 or 17 children, and injured a few hundred others. Periodically, Israel attacks Gaza, where there are more than 2 million Palestinians. More than half of them are less than 18 years old. The Gaza Strip used to be called the Gaza District. In 1948, when Israel was established, the Israeli militias and armies displaced most of the Palestinians from what became Israel. And the population of the Gaza Strip, it tripled. And at first, these people lived out in the open and then in tents, and then more permanent housing were built. So most of the people who live in the Gaza Strip are refugees, or the children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren of refugees. And Israel has not allowed these people to return to their homes, ever. And so they're still there, and it's very densely crowded. And Israel and Egypt, to some extent, maintain a military blockade of Gaza and have for 15 years. The area is very impoverished. I think half of the adults are unemployed. And it doesn't have to be that way, because Palestinians are a very well-educated group of people. Palestinians and their supporters have all kinds of blueprints that have been drawn up over the years for how to rebuild Gaza and how to make it prosperous and beautiful. And the Israelis simply don't allow that to occur. They generally refuse to allow building supplies to come into the area. Limited amounts of fuel are allowed in. Even medical supplies and medicines are limited. Electricity is not continuous 24 hours a day like we're used to here. It's a hellish living condition that most of these Palestinians live in, and for the youngest ones, it's what they've experienced since they were born. And why Israel does this, I'm not sure, but I know that they want to maintain control, that Israel is a Zionist state, and that means that the leaders of Israel are a group of Jewish people who have a particular political ideology, which is such that they are determined to maintain total Israeli or Jewish control over Israel and its occupied territories, that the Palestinians will not be involved in any of the important decisions, and that the goal of Israel is to maintain that, to extend that, to perpetuate that, and to reduce Palestinians to poverty and to hopelessness, and hopefully the Palestinians will leave. That's what the Israelis want to do. And, you know, this is a horrible system, a horrible ideology, and the Israelis should change it, in my view. And so periodically they bomb Gaza and they murder Palestinians. They've demolished 60,000 Palestinians' homes since 1967, which is almost 1,000 a year. They even destroy schools. They've bombed hospitals and clinics. They cut down Palestinian olive trees. They damage the economy. It's really a very bad situation.
You mentioned preventive attacks. How would you respond to the argument that the Israelis feel threatened from the Palestinian, from the Gaza Strip?
Well, I think the Israelis are threatened by the Palestinians from the Gaza Strip, but the reason they are is because they impose such hellish conditions on the Palestinians. If the Israelis were to treat the Palestinians as their brothers and sisters, to treat them fairly and equally, I think over the course of a few years or a few decades, the tensions would evaporate as the oppression ended. And I'm certain that that would occur. But when people are cornered and they're fenced in and they're periodically attacked, some of them are going to fight back. And that's what happens. The same thing would happen to anybody, that you or I have a right to self-defense if we're under attack. It may not be the best thing to do, but we have every right to do it. So Israel needs to ease up on end the repression and become the country that it says it is. And I think then there would be no threats, or there would be very few threats. I mean, there would still be occasional violence because some people would always hate each other, but it wouldn't be like it is now.
Pretty much all the parties rallied together to get Netanyahu out of office. What has changed now that Netanyahu is no longer in the highest power?
I'm not sure that anything has changed. I talk to Israelis and I talk to American Jews and I talk to Palestinians, and many of them say that Israeli elections don't change anything as far as the Palestinians are concerned, that the new Israeli leaders are these hardcore Zionists determined to keep expanding Israel and to not make peace with the Palestinians. And so from the perspective of many of the Palestinians, I know it's like it doesn't matter who wins the Israeli elections, that really nothing changes for the better and things just keep gradually, slowly changing for the worse.
So Biden, on a recent trip over to the Middle East, he met with Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas. Where does Biden's stand in supporting peace negotiations? And in addition to Biden, what other world powers are getting involved in this Israel-Palestine conflict?
I'm not sure I can answer the second part about what other world powers are getting involved. Surely the United States is the key player. The United States provides Israel with billions of dollars in military aid every year. And the United States also provides Israel with diplomatic protection at the United Nations. I think without that protection, the UN Security Council would have imposed sanctions on Israel a long time ago, which might have forced them to change their ways. As far as Biden's trip, he met with Abbas. Abbas, I think, is 85 years old. He's been in power for a long time. There haven't been Palestinian elections in 15 years. He's viewed by many Palestinians as a corrupt conniver with Israel, that he's illegitimate, that he's like a second occupier to some of the Palestinians, that the Israelis are like the main jailer and he's like the internal jailer. I know I hate to talk like that, but this is what some Palestinians think. Although he maintains a bureaucracy, so people work for his Palestinian Authority, so he does have some support. But the Palestinians need elections, and they need to have elections that are internationally observed and that are fairly conducted, which they've done in the past. The last time they had elections was in 2000, I think, 5 or 6, and Jimmy Carter observed them, and he said they were about the most fair elections he'd ever seen in his life. And he had been to elections in many countries. So the Palestinians need elections. They need to, all of them need to be able to vote. The Palestinians are very much physically separated. People from the Gaza Strip can't travel to the West Bank or vice versa. People from the Gaza Strip generally can't leave at all. It's about twice the size of Manhattan along the Mediterranean. Many people in the West Bank can no longer travel into East Jerusalem, even though East Jerusalem used to be part of the West Bank. There are Palestinians who live in refugee camps in Syria and in Jordan and Lebanon. Many of them cannot leave those refugee camps, or they can't leave those countries. So Palestinians are physically divided, and it would be tricky to set up a system where they could all vote, which is what they should be allowed to do. And I think if they could vote, much better leadership would emerge than what we've got with Hamas and with Fatah and the Palestinian Authority. I'm certain of that they would have way better leaders, and probably a lot of women leaders and younger people. I would like to see Biden rescind or revoke some of these Trump policies where the United States recognized Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, for Biden to revoke that, to repeal that, to say, no, that's not our policy anymore.
And just briefly giving context to why Jerusalem is important here?
It's a very important religious city for three major religions.
Well, great. Thank you so much for joining us today on Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
Well, thank you very much.
So we do piece segments every Wednesday. That was Tom Ellis, representing the local Palestinian Rights Committee. You can check out our various piece segments by going to mediasanctuary.org, and on the search button, just type in the word peace.
For those of you just tuning in, I'm Sally Becker.
And I'm Mark Dunley. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network on WOOCLP 105.3 FM Troy, WOOGLP 92.7 FM Troy, WOOSLP 98.9 FM Schenectady, and WOOALP 106.9 FM Albany. This program originates from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York.
It's Black August, and many still don't know what that means or recognize the name George Jackson. All of us held a conversation about the history of Black August, and this is just 10 minutes of an almost hour and a half long recording.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to those that are joining us for this important conversation about what is Black August. My name is Jamaica Miles, co-founder of All of Us. Just going to kick it right over to Sean Young to introduce our panelists.
Thank you. Thank you, Jamaica Miles. I appreciate it. Appreciate the intro and welcome everybody to this discussion on Black August. My name is Sean Young. I am the co-founder of All of Us Community Action Group. Peace. As my brother Tamar says, I have some fantastic panelists.
Hello, my name is Richard Rivera, formerly incarcerated. I entered prison in 1981. When I was 16 years old, I couldn't read or write, and I served 39 years. I'm currently working in Tompkins County with homeless population, and I'm also the director of academic mentoring for Cornell's Prison Education Program.
Peace, everyone. My name is Tamar Cancer. Similar to Rich, formerly incarcerated, was released last year, April, after serving 21 years. While I was in there, I got educated. Likewise, now I'm working with Center for Community Alternatives. I'm director of special projects in Albany, New York. I'm glad to be here.
My name is Michael Capers. I was sentenced to 14 years at the age of 16 for possession of a weapon. And I was just released in February of this year. I'm passionate about health and wellness, and that's the despair I'm in right now. Yeah, nice to meet you all.
So my name is Moshe Canty. I spent a total of 22 years incarcerated, where I became politicized, and that's where I met George at, right there in those SHUs.
Black August, right? It starts with the acknowledgement of the life of one George Jackson and his assassination in San Quentin. All right. So George Jackson is best known for in part for his memoir, The Soledad Brothers. It contains letters that he wrote from prison from 1964 to 1970. He ends up in prison for an armed robbery of $71 with a sentence of 1 year to life. Jackson spent the next few years being transferred between California prisons, often in solitary confinement, and became immersed in the radical political theory that he learned from fellow compatriot W.L. Nolan. Jackson was returned to Soledad prison in 1969. In 1970, he and two others were accused of killing a guard. The three folks that were with him became known as the Soledad Brothers. The collection of the letters that he wrote were published, and it was titled The Soledad Brother. On August 7, 1970, Jackson's younger brother, as I just mentioned, this is the anniversary of that. Jonathan attempted to break him out of the Soledad, break one of the Soledad brothers from prison by taking hostage at Marin County, California courtroom. Police opened fire on all the hostages, killed everyone but one person, including the judge. After that, Soledad brothers were transferred to a high security section of San Quentin prison in the summer of 71. And on August 21st, 1971, George was killed while attempting to escape. At least that's what they claim. They claim that he was attempting to escape San Quentin during an armed insurrection that left six people dead. Jackson's death occurred. How it actually happened remains controversial and unfounded to this day. So that's a little bit of history of George Jackson. So although All Black August started off with that history and honoring George and his brother and the lives lost, it also broadened to like acknowledge all the history, all this magnificent history that happens to place itself in August. All right, so Sundiata Tate's description of Black August was that it is the time to embrace the principles of unity, self-sacrifice, political education, physical training, and resistance. Black August is a month that holds space for political education, the study of Black history, the resilience and resistance. It was started by incarcerated people in the 70s. The month of August is rich with the history of Black resistance, from the Haitian Revolution to the Watts Rebellion to San Quentin Prison Rebellion and the Ferguson Uprising. Black August is a reminder of the power of unity and a mandate to continue the joint struggle. The four principles that we are going to talk about mainly today is the study, fast, train, and fight. Why is it important to fighting for Black liberation today? And what does it mean for us to be a community in light of that struggle?
I came in January 1981, just less than 10 years removed from the Attica riot. I entered the Department of Correction in 1982. And the attitude was that we had to each one teach one, that we had to prevent each of them becoming a victim of the system. And one of the things that I did early on in my bid, when I was learning how to read and write, was to, I was exposed to Soledad Brother. And I didn't understand a word. And this guy is such an incredible and amazing writer, but I didn't understand the words. And I set myself to write each letter by hand over and to learn the words, to look up the words I didn't understand. And that was one of the big impetus to get me to learn how to read, to recognize words, and to be able to articulate myself. It was an incredible influence in my life. It showed me how to resist, most importantly, how to survive, how to retain my humanity in a debasing and dehumanizing environment. But most importantly, it taught me how to be able to harness power in a place where I'm powerless. So one of the big moves I used to do when I went to the box, I used to go on hunger strikes. Had I went in there and not gone on a hunger strike, I would be treated in a degrading manner. I would be denied stuff. They would mess with my meals. You know what I mean? And it's that little bit of power you get by that form of resistance. And that's what George Jackson's doing, right?
What makes a person that's been through incarceration so aware or so willing, not just to resist, but able to resist, to able to see through that kind of monotonous way of life, through that rigid kind of way of being, and see through like to this, to different ways of being and different ways to enact power. Like, you all came home, you didn't have to get involved in this liberation fight. You didn't have to do the work that you do, but you are doing it. What makes someone that's been through that experience right for that life?
I think it's like the four principles that he mentioned, like for Black August, like study, train, fast, and fight. In prison, I learned to do all of them. So I studied, I became conscious of the conditions that are persistent inside of our community. And like, once you know something, it's up to you to use that knowledge for the better. So that was the first step for me. It was understanding the conditions and learning about my community and what needs to be done. Training is mental and physical for me. You know, it's like meditation, it's exercising, it's preparing the body to do the things that you wanted to do. And resistance. So in prison, we're constantly resisting the powers that be. We're resisting the subjugation that the officers that are there are trying to perpetuate. We're always resisting. So I think that it's like the fight is embedded in who we are, how we are. And then when we come out here, it's only right for us to do what's necessary because we've been through it.
Yeah, definitely agree with what Michael said. I also believe that we get used to, prison is probably one of the most vulnerable places to be. And after a while, we get used to, we learn how to resist from a vulnerable place. We become specialists at asymmetrical warfare, right? When you leave an environment like prison and you come out here, right? It's just I see nothing but abundance. I think that one of the things personally for me, I don't want the tricks and, you know, the traps and the mistakes that I fell for. I don't want anybody else to fall for those. So it's easy. It makes it easy for me to choose this line of work. And you're going to pay me to do this type of work. It's like a non-brainer to me.
not every one of us, right, that's been incarcerated or has been through hardship, you know, gains the tools to resist that hardship and to overcome it and to create solutions around, you know, solving that hardship for others. It's not something that just everyone steps into, right? But I just want to read this passage. George Jackson's own journey is a perfect example of revolutionary potential. You know, Jackson didn't arrive in prison a ready-made revolutionary. He had a history of petty crime and was apolitical during his first years there. He would have been dismissed by many people in society as nothing but a thug, but comrades who knew that he held the potential inherent in every human being found him and took him in. They helped him understand his personal experiences in the context of capitalism and white supremacy. In turn, George Jackson dedicated his life to doing the same for others that were incarcerated.
So the Black Panthers Party was actually the first political movement I sort of immersed myself in when I was still a high school student. Those were very brief excerpts from the almost hour and a half long conversation around the history of Black August by All of Us. You can find a full recording on Facebook of All of Us.
A community-supported land-back effort is taking place on a strawberry farm in Schoharie County. Sandra Deer Standup, a Mohawk woman and longtime land defender and educator, spoke with Sina Bazila Hickey about the work taking place and this weekend's festival.
My name's Sandra Owanagu Deer Standup. It's a long name. I'm a Ganyangihaga woman from Gahnawage, and that reservation is close to the island of Montreal. I'm just an hour from Akwesasne and another Mohawk reserve named Ganasadage. So there's three different Mohawk reservations close in the vicinity of one another. And the other ones are a bit further. We have seven Mohawk communities around the different provinces and states. I'm an educator. I've been an educator for 20-something years, and I've been a student for a university student for a very long time. I've worked in early childhood education for many years. We teach all in the language. There's no English until a certain grade because we've run out of speakers and teachers to fulfill those that obligation to have our immersion all the way up to grade six students. But now we only have up to grade four because we lack the fluent speakers in education.
So welcome to Hudson Mohawk Magazine. So Sandra, this weekend on August 12th to 14th is the Waterfall Community Celebration. And this is a way to celebrate the funding effort for the land back that is taking place on a strawberry farm over in Schoharie County, where the Ganankahaga, the Mohawk people, have ancestral ties. How does it feel when you are on this land?
The first time I've gone there, I felt the connection right away. And to be honest, even in the past, when I've gone to Albany, New York, as a child, there's always been this some kind of connection that I've always felt. It feels very comfortable. And as an adult, you know, I noticed years ago that when I would go through Albany, there's always this feeling that you feel because you know that there's a connection there from our ancestors. So there's always been this feeling of some type of connection, but I wasn't very clear on what that connection was until I went in Troy and we stood there on the Hudson and just to be there around the river. And, you know, there's really not many words to explain it, but it's a feeling that you feel when you're there. It's like a very comfortable feeling and a welcoming feeling. And you feel it right through your body. And that's how I feel when I'm there. And, you know, going to the Schoharie Valley, which is just you know, over the water on the other side of the river. It's the same, you know, the energy there is even seems that it's more powerful than on the Hudson. For me, that connection, that feeling when I've gone there to the waterfall in Schoharie, it's absolutely amazing, the feeling that you get just driving down the 88. When coming into the valley, you feel it there. It doesn't have to be right at the waterfall. The energy of my ancestors are there. And when it's just so powerful, the feeling that I get. And everybody that I've spoken to are people, when they drive up there, they have the same feelings. That energy of that power of our ancestors, it's such a welcoming feeling. There's no other words to explain it, because it's a feeling that you feel when you come into contact, you know, in connection with the energy around the Schoharie Valley. Yeah.
So the energy is obviously there. And what you are working on, and I believe you're leading, is the cultural work after the purchase of this land, which is a different kind of relationship. How are you planning to recreate the cultural relationship?
Well, first of all, like as an educator, we're looking to bring back education through education. But of course, we're not looking to follow the square box of what education really, you know, when you define it. What we're looking at is to bring our own cultural teachings back through the land, working on the land, being on the land, that reciprocal reciprocity. That's what it is. You give and the land gives back to you. You give love, you give care, you give, you know, you treat the land with respect. You get back what the land is going to give you, you know, and for that, it's a berry farm. That portion of the land is a berry farm. So that whole abundance of those berries, that when it gives back to the people, you know, that is a whole teaching in itself. And another teaching, a very important teaching, is about the strawberries in our culture. In our culture, that is the first fruit that comes out of the ground. And that is one of the first fruit that we give thanks for when before the summer. So this is the whole land back is in conjunction with the teaching to bring our original teachings back to our children. And in the language, because the language holds key understandings to the environmental connection that we have with the land. You know, the English translations are very hard to translate our language, but we make do, you know. But when you speak the language, there's a feeling in the language that you totally understand it, because our language is very descriptive. So bringing back the teachings with through the language, through the land, you know, for me as an educator, working in universities, the hot topic word over the last, say, maybe 10 years has grown is the word decolonization. So this whole project is a whole process of decolonization, because a lot of our people are colonized. And this is the reason why our culture has been fading away quicker than we know. So decolonization is just living through our culture, bringing back that land, bringing back the connection and that reciprocal way of living with the land. That's the whole connection about being an Indigenous person. So bringing those teachings back is one of the main goals with this land back effort.
And you mentioned the white box of education, the fact that you're an educator. It sounds like this is also a way for your community to have agency over its own re-education.
Oh, yes. Because as an educator working for different organizations over the last 20 some years, it's mainly the government who pushes their agenda. And mainly the government who pushes the type of education that's going to be, you know, shown to the children. And from my original teachings and my perspective, that is not how children learn, because all children learn differently. You know, the goals that we're trying to reach with this, the gathering the funding and donations and trying to raise money for these efforts to bring back Ganyang Gehaga people to the valley, you know, that's the whole part of it. Education part is a very key point. Because I'm an educator and have many years of experience, I'm kind of maybe spearheading it, you want to say. I'm not in charge. I don't take any responsibility of being the head of anything. That's not how we operate. We collaborate and we work together as women to, you know, decide and talk about all of our ideas.
Thank you so much for joining us. For listeners who are interested in learning more, WaterfallUnityAlliance.org has information on this celebration that's taking place on this weekend. What else would you like to leave our listeners with, Sandra?
Well, I would like to say Nyawa Gowa, that means thank you very much in my language, and Dagwanungaradu, I'm offering my acknowledgement and respect to everyone. And if you're going to come to the event, please come and enjoy the music. And we're going to have a lot of different music. Our own traditional music will be performing, you know, just to like to show our music and show some of the dances we have and just to share our culture in different ways.
So I did check out the website and I noticed that Roberto Macauta Borrero is speaking. We did a number of forums together around the Green New Deal in New York City, particularly Riverside Church. Peter Yarrow, who was quite active in supporting Alice Green for mayor of Albany around the criminal justice issue, and then her daughter, Peter, for Peter, Paul, and Mary, Bethany Yarrow, who often sang at 350 NYC climate change events. The celebration, Waterfall University Unity Celebration, takes place from August 12th to 14th. Visitors can drop in or stay for the whole weekend, and that's waterfallunityalliance.org.
Managing Director of Arthur's Point Farm, an ecologically friendly and sustainable farm in Ghent, New York, Dave Newman spoke with Anna Kathawala about the work the farm is doing and the messages they're trying to spread.
Great. Hello, everyone. We are joined today by David Newman, the Managing Director of Arthur's Point Farm, an ecologically friendly farm located in Ghent, New York. David, thank you so much for being here.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Of course, yeah. So I guess to start us off, if you could introduce yourself and Arthur's Point Farm, that would be wonderful.
Sure. Well, I'm an environmental lawyer by training and by practice for many years. I worked with the Natural Resources Defense Council, doing mainly marine conservation litigation and advocacy work. I also happened to, way back when, live in Nairobi for a few years. And in that time, I was able to work in the agricultural sector there, focused on questions around biofuels, liquid biofuels, and food security. And what it did is it introduced me to small-scale farming in a much different part of the world. But it really got me hooked. So when we moved back to the U.S., we looked for a spot to start a farm. And that was in Ghent about 10 years ago. What we were really focused on doing is figuring out ways to make farming more climate friendly, more ecologically friendly, and practicing those approaches that have been developed over the years and promoting them. So we settled on planting a lot of trees, and that's what we started with, which was just taking a lot of old pasture that was tired and underutilized, being used for kind of marginal hayland, and starting to plant out trees. And as we did that, we developed a nursery, and we started selling trees to people, and a consulting practice, and we started working on biochar and some other projects, and that's what evolved into what is now Arthur's Point Farm.
That's amazing. That's such a crazy journey and very, very cool. All right. So can you tell us, like, maybe just a little bit more pointedly about what you're trying to achieve at Arthur's Point Farm and sort of like what sort of conversations you hope to spark, that kind of thing?
Yeah. Well, as the climate warms and as we have more volatile weather, which I think is something we're experiencing every year more and more, whether it's long periods of weather well above 90 degrees, and in some cases well above 100 degrees, whether it's very dry seasons like we've had this summer, it hasn't rained much. I think we're about maybe a quarter of the amount of rain that we normally will get in July, and it doesn't look like it's abating in August. That could be followed by a massive storm where we get 2 or 3 inches of rain. And when the ground is dry after a long period of dry weather, it's hard. And often, if there's no vegetation or little vegetation on it, all that water will just run off and we'll lose it. So really, it's about how do we evolve farming and land stewardship in a way which will make us more resilient in the face of volatile weather like that? And how do we maintain productive, profitable farms that work with nature in balance to manage the additional challenges of climate change, exotic pests and diseases, other invasive species, and development? All of those things having a kind of a cumulative impact on how well we can farm and what we farm. So what we are trying to do is promote agroforestry approaches to farming, which are ancient and widely practiced throughout the world, especially in tropical areas, but increasingly in temperate areas as well. It's basically including trees into your farming system, whether it's silvopasture, where you're grazing animals amidst a sparsely wooded area to promote shade or provide shade and animal health, and to promote grasses growing when it's drier and hotter out, or whether it's a living hedgerow separating your fields, providing again shade and sometimes forage for animals that drop from the different fruits and nuts that you can plant in those hedgerows, or whether it's orchard. And we've got a lot of orchard in New York State, and they're predominantly apple and some pear. So we are promoting a wider array of fruit and nut crops like chestnut and hickory, hazelnut, walnut, persimmon, pawpaw, mulberry, currants, which we believe with the right scale and the right value addition can help make farms in our area competitive for a long time to come, and also more resilient and more robust.
That's amazing. That is so cool. And I guess, like, sort of following up on that, obviously Columbia County is sort of like a more traditional farming area where people are I think, sort of less, they don't practice those things as regularly. So when you are sort of sharing what you do, do you find that you come up against resistance within the farming community? Or is it something that people sort of accept and are excited to try?
There's no resistance, because we're not trying to force anyone to do anything that they don't want to do. And I think farmers, like a lot of practical people, will adopt new practices based on their observations of what other farms that they know are doing. They will adopt things that work, that are practical, that that pay for themselves, or where there's a clear benefit for the cost. I mean, that's what it comes down to. There's always too much work to do on a farm. And so if you're talking about riparian restoration or pollinator habitat or bringing in some additional ecological value to your farm, you really have to make a case that there's a benefit to that, to the farm, and or provide resources in the form of payments for those ecological services to farmers. Farmers are the modern land stewards. They are the folks who have the largest impact on our land in this area, and have the greatest capacity and knowledge and skill to implement a lot of these projects. And so working with people, meeting people where they're at, trying to understand their challenges, whatever they may be, and then looking for things that will help make their farms more productive, more robust, more in balance. I think there's a wide audience for that, and there's no one size fits all approach. And for some people, they may not have the interest or the time, and that's fine because there are plenty of people out there who really do. So I think this is an increasingly aware community. I don't want to say one homogenous community, but I think farmers are so close to the weather that they experience weather in a way that most of us don't on a regular basis. And they're attuned to these changes. You know, if the orchard is leafing out and flowering earlier in the season than it was, you know, 30 years ago, and we can look at phenology records and see that this is the case, what happens when that occurs and you have more, you know, volatile weather in the spring, you can still get a freeze. And so that makes our fruit more at risk. That's just one of many examples that, you know, are at top of mind for farmers. And I think there's a ready audience there. The challenge is having models that are implemented in the real world and not just theoretical. And that's what we're doing on our farm and with consulting clients and with our customers who are buying our trees and our wildflowers. We're working on practical solutions, not theoretical, not a change in policy that might at some point affect us and change the behavior in the real world, but actually showing people what it looks like to restore an area or to implement one of these agroforestry practices.
That's amazing. All right, and then just last question. Could you tell us a little bit about how home gardeners or farmers in the area can get more involved in the work that you guys are doing?
Yeah, I mean, we're not just focused on farmers. So that's the first thing. We are very interested in helping anyone that wants to plant trees or perennial wildflowers, native plants that are helping to really enhance the ecology in their local area. So whether it's someone with a backyard who wants to put in a few fruit or nut trees or a pollinator habitat or a wildflower garden, or whether it's you know, a farm of many hundred acres, there's an opportunity to plant trees. And the best way to interact is to check out our website in about 3 or 4 weeks when we put our fall bare root shop online, and there's an opportunity to buy plants, which will be bare root plants, which are available for shipping or pickup in the late fall. Then we'll have the store will reset, and over the winter we'll be selling trees and wildflowers for spring. So folks that would like to plant in April, which is the kind of an optimal time to be planting a lot of these things before things are leafed out, before everything is growing, getting those roots in the ground when the soil is moist and the temperature is very moderate. It's a great time. And winter is also a great time to be shopping for trees. So check out our website at arthurspointfarm.com. And again, that shop for the fall will go live in about 3 or 4 weeks, but you can still go and browse and see what we have available.
Fantastic. Well, David, thank you again for making the time and for being on here.
And that was young climate activist Anna Kathawala speaking to the David Newman of Arthur's Point Farm in Ghent, New York.
And that's our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Sally.
And I'm Mark Dunley, engineer with Sina Basila Hickey. We want to thank all of the volunteers who made this episode possible. Today's contributors included Anna, Sally Becker, and myself.
Thank you for listening. Until next time.